Before we begin, this episode deals with death, loss, mourning, and grief. If you're not feeling up to it, maybe take a pass for now. And of course, hail Hecate. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Keeping Her Keys. Today, I'm sharing a fabulous interview we did with Laura Perry, who's written so many books. The book that caught our attention was an anthology that she edited on death walking, which is being a guide to help someone transition to the other side, and also a medium, someone who can communicate with those on the other side. We recorded this episode a few months ago, and it's a great episode to go deeper into the chapters in Entering Hecate's Cave on Psychopomp and Anassa Anaroi, which means the Death Queen. As things sometimes happen, we had delayed releasing this episode because we were doing the archiving work of going back and looking at earlier episodes that I had done, talks that I had done that we thought were really fundamental to my teaching. And I just want to give a huge shout out to Kristen again, who is also in charge of Hecate's kitchen in the coven, for all of her work on the transcriptions. So this interview was recorded, like I said, a couple of months ago. And we knew we were going to release it today. That was the plan. As things go, my own mother left this world just a couple of days ago. I love my mom. She was a generous person. She was always up for an adventure. She loved me and my sister and our sons. She was always there when I was going through really rough times years ago. She helped me out in ways that I am eternally grateful for. We were fortunate enough to be with my mom when she left this life, and it was sad and beautiful, and I miss her so much. So even though this episode had been on the schedule for today, it is most appropriate for where I am at in grieving my mom. If you are grieving a loved one, and do we ever really stop grieving? If you are called to do this kind of work, to be a soul guide for others as they transition, or a medium, someone who can connect with those on the other side, I offer you this episode as well. It's a beautiful conversation. Coyote May, who is one of the guides in Covina, join me to interview Laura. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Keeping Her Keys. Today, we are going to be talking with Laura Perry, who is the author of a fantastic book on death walking. It's a really touching anthology with many different voices sharing their experiences of guiding the departed to the other side and connecting to the other side, which is sometimes called psychopomp. Psychopomp translates to soul guide. And it is certainly one of the central roles of Hecate. And in Entering Hecate's Cave, I talk about being a psychopomp in terms of using it as an analogy for guiding our own selves back to our soul. And when I wrote that chapter, I knew I wanted to do an episode where we talked about actually doing psychopomp work with departed others. So I'm super happy that Laura is here today to talk about this. And I'm joined again by Coyote May, who is a member of the Inner Circle in Covina, our Coven of Hecate. And I think we're just going to have a really interesting conversation. Of course, talking about psychopomp work is a subject that can bring up memories of our own grief and loss. So if you are not feeling up to a conversation about the departed and connecting with the departed, you might want to skip this episode. If you are curious, or if you have had experiences where you felt the departed were seeking your help, or if you feel connected to your departed loved ones, this is definitely an episode that I know you'll get so much out of. So as is our practice, we'll begin with a simple candle ritual. So if you have a candle handy, you might want to grab that and do it along with us. So let's just move that candle in that counterclockwise motion. And I use my left hand. And that creates the energy of purification. So important in any work with the departed, to purify ourselves, to keep our space cleansed. And then casting that protective circle around us. And in working with the departed, protection is such an important aspect. So we have purified our space and ourselves and protected ourselves and connected to each other and the spirit of this conversation that we're about to have. We're going to start today with the prayer to Hecate for the dead. This isn't a prayer that I've ever published anywhere. I'll make it available in the show notes. I'll link to it. This is a very special prayer that I wrote many, many years ago when someone who I was very close to died very, very suddenly at a young age. And I was grappling at the time with how death doesn't discriminate. Death comes for us all. In death, we are all equal. And also in the way that a spirit who is surprised by their own demise can come to us to seek our help because they don't even know what's happened, because they are as shocked by the turn of events as the living are. So this was the origin for this prayer. So I'll read this prayer, and it is my offering to everyone. If you are dealing with loss, I hope this prayer brings you some comfort. Hail Hecate, mighty eternal queen, divine mediator, great psychopomp, she who walks between the worlds, torchbearer who shines her light upon our path. Hear us now, mistress of death, Anessa Enneroy, welcome the departed into your realm. I call upon you, great light, embrace the souls as they pass through the gates of death. Guide our beloved safely to the other side, offering comfort as they cross your threshold, from this life to the next. Be with all those who feel grief and loss. May they know the peace of eternity. Let the light of memory burn bright for all of us who remain. Give us the comfort in knowing that all that dies shall be reborn. I think grief and loss is so challenging, and in general is a subject that I think kind of in modern mainstream culture, especially here in North America, it's a subject that we're not very comfortable with talking about. And for those who feel connected to the departed, who, you know, can sense spirits or, you know, whatever it is, that there's almost this even greater kind of distancing or silencing where we don't feel comfortable talking about our experiences in certain rooms or with certain people. And this is why I really wanted to do this episode. So maybe we could just begin by sharing some of our own experiences with the departed. When I was contemplating this episode, my first thought was like, where would I even begin? Because the dead have always been with me. I don't know, Laura, like, do you know what I mean by saying like the dead have always been with me?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are some of us who are just aware of them from a very early age. And we also discover, most of us from a very early age, that talking about that makes everyone else very uncomfortable. It's modern Western culture, particularly in North America, is extremely uncomfortable with the concept of death, to the point that, you know, if a family member dies, you get 3 days off from work and then you're expected to show back up as if nothing had happened. There were many things that were not great about the Victorian era, but let's be honest, I think a lot of us would be a lot healthier mentally and emotionally if we had a prescribed mourning period after close family members and friends died, where people knew to offer us compassion or give us our space or whatever, instead of expecting us to continue to perform. And then the flip side of that is, since people don't like talking about death, whether it's me dying or someone else dying, we don't like talking about the concept of the spirits of the dead being around us, being in relationship with us. It's even within the pagan community, it's an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people, I have found. But it's also a subject that people are absolutely fascinated by, right? And so, yeah, that's an interesting kind of balance to try to manage.
And I think for me, like as a Hecatean, you know, the aspects of Hecate that really are about the departed and spirits and her governing, you know, like a horde of the restless dead and so on, like those kind of more frightening aspects of Hecate are also the most beguiling for many people. You know, there's something about it that it seems dangerous, and that is why it can be so attractive, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Victorians knew how to do death right.
Yes. Yeah, I think part of the reason it's so beguiling, as you say, is that it reflects our own power back to us, our mortality and our immortality. In ways that transcend words and that get something across that our culture does not convey well.
I think that's such a good point, because we don't get like a vocabulary.
Yeah.
On how, you know, what the words are, or even what the emotions are in terms of like grief and loss. You know, like you said, that we get 3 days off from work and then we're supposed to go back. We don't wear an armband, or there's nothing to signal from our outward appearance that we are mourning the loss of someone. And we are just supposed to get back to being workers and to perform, like you said. Like, it's so true. There is so little space in kind of like North American mainstream culture for anything that takes us outside of like productivity. And death, like death doesn't care about productivity.
Right.
Whether it's working with spirits or when we are dealing, you know, when we are in the valley of grief and loss. So, you know, there is that kind of gap between this emphasis on productivity and chronological time and getting it done, and also that death doesn't care about any of those things.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's about our mortality and also that immortality. And it, you know what it's bringing up for me is this idea of the difference between, you know, like chronos, chronological time, and kairos, you know, the time of the gods or the deeper world. And right. To me, that's like death and the spirits work on kairos.
Right.
And any kind of psychopomp work, I think is in a sense, like you are connecting to that kairos time where things aren't linear. This may not go in a, you know, this may not go in a nice three-step plan, because the departed, I think they lose their sense of chronological time after they are, you know, once they're kind of out of the human hangover and they're more in the world of spirit, that, so we can have visitations from like a restless spirit that come to us and they have no sense of how long they've been on the other side. I don't know. Has that ever happened to either of you, when you felt like someone was really like, well, you died several years ago and you're still kind of acting as though no time has passed?
Yeah. Well, I think it's almost like they have no more concept of time. Once the human hangover, as you call it, dissipates, I think the time stream goes away along with that. And so there is no more sense of time for them. And so that's sort of an anchor that we have, mm-hmm. and that we try to fit things into for our own psychological comfort. but yeah, I have dealt with spirits who passed away several hundred years ago who didn't understand that it didn't just happen last spring. So yeah.
And in my, like, so I've had experiences like that too. And from working with these spirits, I'm thinking of one situation in particular, from working with the spirits, like there's no point trying to rationalize with them. Like, you can't explain to them that they've been dead for years, that the world has moved on, that, you know, their child or their wife or whoever it is they're looking for is indeed probably dead themselves. So, like, what would you do in a situation like that?
My pretty much, excuse me, sorry, it's pollen season here. Pretty much all of my spirit work involves deities or other spirit allies. And so I typically call on them. I look to find who the appropriate spirit ally is for the particular person, the particular spirit I'm dealing with. And it may not be may not be a deity or ancestor or other spirit ally that I have worked with before. So I always have my basic spirit allies and deities with me to start with, the ones that I do with, that do all my psychopomp work. I have sort of my little committee. For me, there's the goddesses Ariadne and Eileithyia and the Serpent Mother. And then there are, I have a small handful of ancestral spirit guides that I also do this work with. And so I always start out with them. I feel like I'm sort of flanked by them, and we're this group walking together into whatever the situation is. And because I'm not alone, I have someone to consult. And so when I come upon someone, who, a spirit who is confused, or who feels, some of them often feel, they feel dislocated is the term that has been sort of conveyed to me. I get information from my own spirit allies about who can best help them. This is one of the questions that I find myself asking most often when I'm doing psychopomp work is, who can best help here? Because from my point of view, as a psychopomp, I'm just a facilitator. I'm like a project manager. I am helping people get done the things that they need to get done. And in this case, it's helping spirits conclude whatever they need to conclude so that they can step through that doorway. And so, yeah, it varies widely. Sometimes it's one of my own familiar spirit allies. Sometimes it's a deity I have never met before. And so that's part of the sort of adventurous aspect of this. And I'm always humbled when a deity who is associated with other people shows up and says, of course I'll help. Like this is one of the things that they do for people that they are connected with.
That's very similar to my approach. It's like, who, you know, I have my helpmates, and I guess I would even say like teachers or guides, mm-hmm. both, you know, like Hecate, Eileithyia is a very, very connected to Hecate. It's a title. I know it's a spirit that you connect with. And it's also, she's also very connected to Hecate. And Artemis, who is also very important to me as well. And Eileithyia is a really interesting goddess or spirit, whatever you want to call her, in that, you know, this association with like coming into the world and leaving the world. Mm-hmm. And when we like consider that, those are the two thresholds.
Yes.
We are, you know, that when a child is born into this world, that they are coming from someplace deeper. And then when we leave the world, we enter that deep place. And I'd like to hear some more about, I'm really fascinated by Eileithyia. So I'd like to hear some more about your experiences or how you understand her.
Okay, well, My main spiritual practice besides ancestor reverence is Minoan spirituality. And I focus specifically on Bronze Age and Neolithic aspects of that. So my connection with her, and I use a sort of generic ancient Greek pronunciation, which is Eileithyia, and the modern Greek pronunciation would be Eileithyia. My connection with her is in her, with her Bronze Age face. Mm-hmm. When you get to Hellenic times, the main aspect of her that survives into the mythos in that era is that she's a midwife goddess, right? But she's also got a torch So for me, she is, the torch means that she is the underworld face of the sun goddess, in the Mediterranean, in what, one of our tribe members calls tomato Europe, as opposed to potato Europe, which is farther north.
I like that.
In tomato Europe, the old sun goddesses have two specific faces, a world above face and an underworld face. Mm-hmm. And so the world above face is the Minoan goddess, whom we call Tarasia. And then her underworld face is Eleithyia. Just as a side note, in potato Europe, sun goddesses also have two aspects, but they are the winter aspect and the summer aspect. So the climates in those two areas affected the way the people interact with the sun goddesses in the two regions, which I find interesting. So essentially, Eleithyia is the keeper of the underworld. In Minoan spirituality, Ariadne is the guardian of the spirits of the dead specifically. She is the queen bee, the head of the Melissae, who are the ancestral bee spirit goddesses. Mm-hmm. But Eleithyia, and so Ariadne moves back and forth between the world above and the underworld as part of her yearly cycle, very similar to the way Persephone does up in mainland Greece. Eleithyia resides in the underworld and goes as far as the doorway and stands in the doorway in a manner of speaking. And so she her name means the deliverer. And so she is the deliverer of souls from the realm of the ancestors into the realm of the living, and from the realm of the living into the realm of the ancestors. It's never linear. It's always cyclical. And so she is, for me at least, a big help in psychopomp work. She is a torchbearer, so she can light the way. She can show people where the doorway is. A lot of people, even modern pagans, have a conception of the underworld as dark and unpleasant, even if it's not, you know, the Christian hell. It is, there's still this idea that it's like a shadowy place. but from my point of view, in Minoan spirituality, in its Bronze Age aspects, the underworld is the cave of the Great Mother. So this is where Rhea goes at midwinter to give birth to the divine child. This is a place of refuge and safety and peace. And so Eleithyia's, one of her roles is to shine light on that aspect of it, and to help people understand that it's okay to go there, that it's okay to move on, that a good and safe place, and that they don't need to listen to the last 2,000 years worth of propaganda about what the underworld is like. So yeah, I find her to be a very comforting figure. She has helped me deliver parts of myself unto myself repeatedly throughout this lifetime.
So Coyote May, I just want to bring you into this conversation, because Eleithyia certainly is a spirit that we've discussed many times, mm-hmm. in terms of like this role of both being the one who brings souls into this world and the one who brings them to the other side. And just kind of building on that, because, you know, the work of the psychopomp, I think because death is so taboo in our society, And in some ways, you know, childbirth is as well, but we tend to make a bigger fuss and it's more socially acceptable to talk about birth. Like, you know, they have those gender reveal mm-hmm. parties these days.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Oh, right. Like, so, so, you know, it, I think we need to say yes, you know, like having this deliverer to help as a spirit. And I certainly connect with her to help, you know, guide new souls into this world. But this aspect of the cyclical nature of life. And mm-hmm. I know you've had a lot of experiences with that, like in different ways throughout your life. So I'd like to hear like more of your thoughts just on this whole, like, how is life cyclical? I guess in the great bookends of like corporeal existence.
Right. I mean, it's such a liminal space, right? I mean, it's, both death and childbirth are, you know, as Laura said, there it's like you're at the doorway, you're at a threshold in both of those places. It could even be the same threshold. I mean, how often are people very close to death when they're in the middle of childbirth, whether they're the child being birthed or the person giving birth to the child? So, I mean, I think that's an aspect that we really don't deal with because, I mean, think about how we celebrate the birth of a child, or we celebrate pregnancy, or we celebrate, I mean, in our culture, it's like we make such a big deal out of this new life, this potential coming into the world. But like, what happens if there's a miscarriage? What mm-hmm. happens if the child dies soon after birth? What happens if the mother dies while in childbirth? Then it's like, hush, hush, you know, I mean, I feel like it's quickly something that's like, oh, all of a sudden it's like everything just gets cut off. You know, there's no rallying really around, you know, the person who sustained this loss. There's no, you know, it's just like any other death. It's like, okay, what, people don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with this. They don't know how to be there for somebody necessarily. I think I've shared with you that my mother lost a child very shortly after birth when I was about 12. So I was on the threshold of puberty. I really needed my mother, right? And she was going through this loss. And it was a loss that happened to all of us, obviously. I mean, and I remember just feeling like I didn't know. I was a child. I didn't know how to deal with this. I needed my mother. And at that time, I was living with my mother, as we've talked about. You know, most of the time I was with my dad, but at that time I actually was living with my mother. She had custody of us. I needed somebody. She could not be there for me. She just couldn't. You know, I mean, and I look back now with adult eyes, and I can understand that, right? But I was just like, okay, like, how do we move on from this? And I don't think it's something you ever do move on from, really, right? You know, and there's a lot of tenderness there that I have now as an older adult looking back at that aspect of life. I have tenderness for myself as a child who needed their mother. And I have a lot of tenderness for my mother who just was going through all of this with really very little support. You know, I mean, of course, we had the church members that came over and brought casseroles and things like that. But it was like, really, she went through a lot of this alone, you know. And so she has since moved across the country, and I still live near where the baby's buried. And so she'll ask me to go take flowers to the grave and things like that. And so I've kind of become this emissary for her, you know, to keep that tradition going, even though she doesn't live here anymore. And, but, you know, then I've also been present when I was a massage therapist. I did labor massage. So I've been present at all these births as well, you know, and just that, I mean, there are some moments where you're just like, it never gets old, that awe and that, like, you know, all of a sudden there's this new life, right? And it's a very sacred time. And I think, you know, as much as our society, we throw the bridal showers, we shower, you know, the family with gifts, we, you know, give all this attention to the new baby. It's just like, I almost feel like there's no appropriate sacredness for that, you know, that just that moment in time where it's like, now there's this new life. And where did this life come from? And where is this soul going? And I don't know. It's just, it's so big. And I just feel like those things are not very well acknowledged in our society, just like death isn't.
One thing that I've noticed, particularly in one of my children, is that when they were very young, they clearly had a strong connection to the other side and could perceive like spirits. And I would also, we're not really getting into past lives today, but I'll just throw that in, and that they were also connected to their previous incarnations. And for me, that was always evidence like of this cyclical nature of life. Mm-hmm. That young children can often see spirits. They don't have the maturity to act as a spirit guide because they're young children, but they do have this affinity, and they can see and talk to spirits and know things about the departed that they have no way of knowing. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, that's almost like the spirit of Alethea as well. You know, that mm-hmm. they're, you know, that children demonstrate this. Mm-hmm. And in you know, in particular, like some places, I remember one time we went to this battle location from the 18th century. And it was a very kind of rural site. It wasn't like a big, you know, national historic thing. It was something near like my family's ancestral home. And we just went there on a whim. You know, I said, oh, I think there is this ancient fort here, and there was this battle, and there's like a plaque in the woods, you know, there's no parking or anything. And so we went in there, and they had this really interesting experience. And a very young child, you know, just talking about like the battle and the people, and, you know, just really being connected to what I would almost say, like, that is a spirit of place, as opposed to maybe mm-hmm. any individual spirit. Mm-hmm. So there's something there, like with children, and there's something that I think, like you were saying, Laura, where in our society, this is not a topic we're very comfortable with. We're intrigued by it. Long Island medium, and that that other fellow whose name I always forget. I think his first name is Tyler. You know who I mean? Like, he does the celebrity talks, he's on YouTube. That we're intrigued by it, by being able to communicate with spirits and be a spirit guide. And then we're also really uncomfortable with it. And some of us do seem to have like a natural born talent for this. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Meg? Like, do you think it's a, like, that being a psychopomp or being a medium or being a psychic or whatever word? We don't even have, we have way too many words, and most of the words don't even talk, like, really cover what this is all about. Because right. I think, linking back to what you said, Laura, it's difficult. We don't have the vocabulary for this, especially right. in English in particular. We don't have the vocabulary for this. So do you think, like, this is like a natural born skill, that some people have this?
I wouldn't say that you can't develop it, but I think that, like, a lot of any, you know, anything, whether it's, you know, a natural ability to, or quote unquote natural ability to, you know, play an instrument or, you know, create art, it's something that you can learn. But I think that some people are just kind of more well suited to it or open to it, because I can definitely think about my childhood and how I just, like you said, I mean, it was just like the spirits were just there. Like, I didn't always see them as individual entities, but more of like that felt sense of somebody's here with me. I remember as a child, I had a set of grandparents. It was my dad's father and his second wife, who lived about 3 hours north of us. And so we didn't see them very often. And the wife's mother was actually somebody that I, you know, I have pictures of us together from when I was very, very young, but I don't remember her like in this life. Like, I don't remember really spending a lot of time with her. I remember that she was kind. And I remember we were visiting with those grandparents, and I was like, oh, I said, Grandma Thelma is here. And her daughter, my Grandma Margaret, was just like shocked. She was like, she's passed, she's been, you know, and she was very Christian, and which most people in my family weren't, but she happened to be. And so she was like, what are you talking? You know, she was just horrified, you know, like, why are you saying that? She's, you know, she passed, she's not here. And I was like, no, she's right here. She misses us. You know, she wanted to see me. And it was just like, they were just, all of the adults, I think, were just like, what is wrong with you? And I think I was about like 5 or 6 at the time. So, you know, I remember that interaction, but I don't really remember. I think she had passed when I was like maybe 3. So I don't have a lot of strong memories about her, but it was like, it almost seemed like every time I did go visit this set of grandparents, like she was around. And so, you know, just that, but it was almost more like that sense of love and like happiness. Like she was happy that we were there and she was happy that we were all together. And so I think that also kind of brings to mind how people can experience this work in different ways. You know, like some people see these entities as like, you know, with human bodies or human shaped bodies or, you know, and they speak. And with me, it's more of like a set, like thoughts and feelings is what I kind of sense. And I think like kids are very open to that sort of thing. Like they haven't been taught yet, you know, that, no, that it's not possible.
I think that's so true. I'm the same way. Like I get a sense. My dad is a sometimes visitor, like here in the house, and he's welcome to come whenever he wants. Dreams in when I'm cooking or when I'm doing home improvement projects, which was his passion in life. So in life as in death, I'll never be a Toronto Maple Leafs fan. So he'll never be able to visit this house and watch the Maple Leafs. So for me, like my dad is a welcome spirit here anytime. I live in a place, I will say to people, well, where I live, the dead far outnumber the living. Because I live in a really small fishing village, you know, whose glory days are about 150 years in the past. There's way more empty houses here. You know, and houses owned by people who are only here in the summer and so on. So thinking about all of this and protecting, like, so for me, I have wards on the house, like energetic shields. So having these wards around my house, because I can always sense, like when there are restless spirits wandering the streets of the village, curious spirits sometimes. And so for me, having been like a psychopomp and having experiences like what you were talking about, May, I've learned that I don't want that as part of my everyday existence. Mm-hmm. You know, if I am called to do like psychopomp work to help guide a restless spirit or to help someone connect with the spirit, I tend to be more in the former. You know, I am more called to helping spirits go transition than to do what we might call mediumship work and talk to the departed for other people. But for me, like, I don't want that as part of my everyday life. I want to live my life, do my thing, and not have a lot of intrusive spirit visits from the restless dead in particular. Because I don't feel like I have an obligation to help a restless spirit. Like I feel for me, like if I am called to help, if I feel like, you know, you were talking, Laura, about having like your personal counsel. Like if I feel like there is a spirit trying to come through that needs my assistance and it makes sense to me on some level in consultation with my counsel that I would offer some assistance to them, that's one thing. But just having like random spirits coming to me or even spirits of people who I was really connected to in life come to me, you know, I have a lot of boundaries around that. And I have one story that I want to share with the two of you. Several years ago, I was in a relationship, a romantic relationship with a person. And this person's former partner was very problematic. Like this was, you know, like people throw around that word, like they're toxic a lot today. But this, like, it, and if we're going to use that word, that person would be like a great exemplar of that. You know, they were manipulative, they lied, they didn't have custody of the children. So I was spending a lot of time with the children. Would call me and tell me off, and you know, all of this, you know, that vitriol, like that very contentious relationship. And I had to have this person in my life to a certain extent because of the children. And as fate, or perhaps not fate, would have it, one day we were at a sporting event for the children, and this person had trouble with their rings. So they had, like, their fingers had swollen up. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so I think just to shut them up, because they would not stop talking about these damn rings and how much they were hurting their fingers, I like agreed to help them get the rings off. And somehow I got those damn rings off. I think, again, I was just like that motivated, like, if I can just make one thing about this better. So that was that. And then my relationship with the parent of these children ended. I moved away, life went on. And then completely unexpectedly, hadn't thought about this, this woman for a long time, completely unexpectedly started to have the sense of her presence. And then that this woman was really insistent, you know, and you know how you know it's a spirit as opposed to you're just having a memory or a thought or some kind of other energetic tap in from a person. And I was like, this feels like something deeper. It feels like she's dead, but she can't be dead. She's like 40 years old. And so it kept happening. It was a very specific message. She wanted me to go back to them and convey this message. And I was like, well, whatever's happening here, these people, my former partner, like, they are not going to believe a word I say because they are completely not into anything woo-woo. So it's a waste of time for me to do this. But then I don't even know if this woman is dead. And so there was a lot, like, she would not leave me alone. She was very upset, you know, just crying and, you know, just all of the kind of like emotions that she had in life. You know, she was a very intense, emotional person, a lot of swearing and crying and, you know, belligerent, but also very empathy activating because, you know, she was in so much pain. So then I did discover that she had indeed died. Well, I mean, I knew this doesn't happen unless someone has actually died, but you know, it's like that external validity is helpful. So I did discover that she had died. And I was just like, no way, like, I'm not helping you do any of these things. And I did consult with my personal counsel, and said, you know, I'm not helping them because I, you know, what they wanted was not for me to help them go to the other side, was for me to convey this message. And basically they wanted me to be a release valve for the guilt and shame they felt about, you know, their life. So I guess they were still in the human hangover stage. And Laura, you have a really awesome YouTube video that I'm going to link in the show notes. And before we kind of turned on the recording, we were talking about this idea of, like, how do you kind of appropriately navigate having this ability? I think especially if, like, you get a visitation like this and you have no idea what's going on or what to do. Like, I, because I've always had these experiences, I knew what to do, which was psychologically to put, like, big fat gambions, you know, big fat, like, walls of rocks around this energy. And that even if she came to me, I was just saying, no, I won't do this. All the best. But I think if someone is having an experience like this and they don't kind of have that fortitude, experience, maybe training, like, how, what would you say would could be something somebody could do in a situation like that? And this is for both of you, because I think there's no one right one way to deal with this situation. Mm-hmm. So maybe Laura, we'll start with you. Like, what would you advise someone to do if they felt like they were having a situation like this?
I think I would start by considering what kind of response I might give if the person were alive and asking me to do something.
That's so good.
Like, yeah, many of us, you know, we want to help, right? It's our automatic impulse. We are compassionate, caring people. We want to help. But sometimes we can't really help, or sometimes it's not healthy for us helping. Sometimes what we want to do doesn't really help, just like in your situation, that wouldn't really have actually helped the other person. It would have just given them an out without having to face what they were dealing with. Yeah, boundaries are every bit as important with the dead as with the living. And maybe even more important, because the presence of the spirits of the dead is more nebulous, right? You can, if some, you know whether a living person is in your house or not, and you can tell them to leave. But because we are, those of us who are aware of them, recognize that the spirits of the dead are around us all the time, it can be harder to come up with those boundaries. But yeah, I would always start by saying, if one of my embodied alive friends or relatives asked me to do this, how would I respond? You know, would I be comfortable doing it? Would I not be comfortable doing it? Would I want time to think about it? You know, that would be the place I would start if I didn't have psychopomp training.
That's a really, really good tip. And something that I've noticed, and I've had like multiple students over the years, like have an experience like where they feel a spirit is calling to them. In some cases, it's been like a famous murder that they feel really aligned to the spirit of the person who was murdered, or it can be like a family member. So they feel like this person is coming through to them and asking for their help in some way, or that they're disquieted. The spirit is disquieted. They're upset. They're crying, you know, like, especially in like traumatic death, you know, there can be a lot of grief that the departed feels. And so when students have kind of started talking about having this experience, like my first advice is always to slow things down, because it can be like, this is super cool. Someone who is departed is connecting with me, and I have the ability to speak with spirits, and that's really cool. And there can be a lot of enthusiasm around this. And I've actually had, I'm thinking of two specific situations when, you know, I was saying, you need to slow this down. Like you were saying, Laura, you know, is this something you would do for a living person? And if just rushing in to help in any situation is your life practice, then I would say, as your teacher, that that's where we need to begin, is with better boundaries and knowing what's right for you and not seeking validation through helping other people. I think that's such a big thing. Like, but you, I don't know, like, have you seen that enthusiasm in people, Laura?
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is, it can make you feel really important if a spirit comes to you and asks you to do this work for them. It can make you feel very important and very special. And that's not why we do this.
Right. And I've always said, like, I don't want to be the special one. Like, you know, people will say to me, oh, I wish I was like you, that I could perceive the spirits of place and the spirits of individuals and, you know, all of these things. And I'm always like, good for you. I actually wish I didn't have this ability because when I was younger, I couldn't effectively protect myself. And, you know, yes, it's a gift, but it's also very intrusive until you learn, you know, to put up those boundaries and so on. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's something, I mean, both of you said it, is like, resist that impulse to rush in and fix everything. Because the other thing that I was thinking is, you know, even like, especially in your example, Cindy, like if you had gone to this family and said, she wants to tell you X, is that actually even going to help them, you know, or is that going to cause them more pain and more guilt and, you know, even if it was well received? And so I think like that's the other component is like, is this really for the higher good of everybody involved? And is it my place? Or is this coming from like, you know, like Laura said, is this coming from a place of ego? Like, I want to be like the hero. I want to run it. And I want to be the special person who talks to spirits. I want to be the person who solves this unsolved murder. I want to be, you know, so I think like really examining your own place in all of this is important. And not to, I mean, obviously not to discredit these experiences, but I also think like our brains like to attach more meaning to things too, right? So like you might have like this vague experience of a spirit who resembles this famous spirit, and then your brain rushes to go, oh, this must be the Black Dahlia or whoever, you know, right? Like, and you know, not to say that it isn't, but you know, it's like those are the kinds of things like where you were saying like maybe this is a time to slow down and pull back a little bit, you know. And so I think like for me, without psychopomp training, I mean, I would just say, you know, like take some time and sit with yourself and think about why you're engaging with the spirit, why you're continuing. Because I mean, the spirit might have tapped you on the shoulder, but why are you continuing to get pulled in? And then how do you extricate yourself? You know, so then I would kind of recommend shielding or, you know, like sending prayers that the spirit finds the help they need, or, you know, some things that you can do that are more focused on yourself versus rushing in to help the spirit and their situation.
I think that's such a good point. And, you know, this, like, it's almost like you want to feel special and you get that validation that you're, you know, you feel special. And that's so tempting because we all want to feel special. I think that's a normal,
it's very human,
yeah, right, for us to want to feel special, mm-hmm, and that we have like some greater purpose in life that we're, you know, like that we're fulfilling. So I really, you know, I think it's really necessary to do that kind of like reflective work and to not rush in and to not feel like you have to help anybody, living or departed or spirits that never knew flesh. Just, you don't have to help people if it isn't right for you. And, you know, it reminds me of the way that sometimes, and I know I've did this when I was younger, it's like we're not kind of feeling like we are whole onto ourselves, or like in a psychological sense that we're connected to our own soul. So it's like we are looking for ways to kind of verify that we have value, mm-hmm, and, you know, to be able to help the restless dead, of course, it's very valuable, in addition to being like a really amazing talent. But I think those who like are really involved in this work have a different perspective. Like, it's not like this is so cool and so amazing and I just want to like cross everybody over and talk to all, mm-hmm, the spirits. It's like, oh, this is really complex, heavy work, that we don't, you know, it's not like we're ghost hunters, like, you know, traipsing around historic sites with flashlights and weird machines. We did this strange thing on vacation last summer. We went on one of those ghost tours. Either of you ever been on a ghost tour?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have.
So like we've gone on kind of like the fun ones, like you go on the like a trolley in Boston or Atlanta or you Philadelphia, you know what I mean? Like kind of this was like in like late at night, and it was a very small group, and it was in this old theater in Toronto, the Winter Garden Theater. It's very famously haunted by the Lavender Lady. So we went. I'd never, like, I don't watch these ghost hunting shows, but one of my sons is a huge fan of them. You know, just because they're so outrageous, I guess, and what they do. Anyway, so we went on this ghost hunting thing, and they had like all of these little gizmos, you know, like little gadgets that to like measure the frequency of the ghost. And as soon as we kind of got in the theater, I was kind of like, well, obviously there are spirits here because, you know, it was late at night, it was a big theater. But it was really still and quiet. And, you know, the spirits of the place would be curious about, you know, this little tiny group of people coming in to do this thing. But I was just thinking a lot about, like, kind of the difference between being a natural psychopomp, being naturally a death walker. You know, the dead are always present. And people who are just like curious about ghosts and stuff. And need all these fancy gizmos because I'm just like, you don't need a Ouija board. What are you using? Like, what are we doing here? I'm not touching your Ouija board. I don't know where that's been. This is a tour you run every week with like 10 people. Like, I am not getting involved with your Ouija board. And it was just such a, you know, you have like those experiences when there's a confrontation with something like how I see the world and how other people see the world. And that, you know, does this make sense? And
It does.
it was such a interesting experience to kind of be in that ghost hunter world for a night. And like the person who leads it, like this is like, you know, they're one of those big name ghost hunters. It was really quite, I'm super glad we went. I'd never do anything like it again. And then just that whole kind of experience of the difference between like being a ghost hunter and someone who like can communicate with the dead as spirits, not like blips on a machine.
Right. I think there's that definite pull to like have that I don't know, like that experimental kind of like validation, right? Like, oh, there's a blip on the machine that equals a ghost, you know, and having that kind of like scientific validation, you know, versus just getting to know the spirits. And then something you've said both in this story and then in your story about your town where you live is about like how there are these spirits that are curious, right? And how when the town or the theater is quiet, the spirits are more easily perceived. And I know like they're always here, but I do think like you're right, like they are curious. They're like, what are you like? It's nighttime or it's winter time. Why are you here? Like, this is our time. This is our time to have, you know, our time to be ourselves, our time, you know, and here you are kind of intruding on this. Like, what are you doing here? And it also made me think about how, you know, we talked about like, is it our obligation to rescue all of these spirits and help them cross over? Because I think like what you said, and it really sparked something in me when you're like, there are these curious spirits. It's like, yeah, some spirits I think are fine. Like they're fine being here. They're, you know, like not like maybe it would help them to cross over, but it's not my job to tell them that. If they're fine hanging out, being curious about what's going on in the living world and they're not, you know, distressed and or even if they were distressed, I mean, is it still my job to rush around going, cross over, you know, like, or can we just kind of coexist? Like, oh, hey, Grandma Selma, nice to see you again. Or hey, Dad, good to see you. Or hey, you know, Paul from 20, oh, you know, whatever, or 1902, who I never knew in life, but you know, I see you here every once in a while, you know, like it's just like you kind of get to know them, and it's just like, oh, that's just Paul. He's hanging out, you know. It's an interesting thing to think about.
It's an interesting thing to think about. Laura, I'd like to know your thoughts on that. Like, I don't, isn't there a kids game or something? Like Red Rover, well, you try to get people to cross over a game. Isn't there some kind of kids game? I know that made me think of that. Like, as a psychopomp, you're just like playing Red Rover, and you're saying, no, you must cross over. You must cross over. You know, it's, I think you make a really good point that I don't feel that if there is like a curious spirit or my dad or whoever comes to visit, that I should be like, no, you need to go somewhere and do something. Like, I can be like, you need to get out of my house and my head. Not welcome.
Right.
But I'm not trying to tell them how to live their afterlife. I don't know, what's been your experience with that, Laura? Like,
yeah, this is an interesting issue. In pre-Christian times, there were people in every family, in every community, whose job it was to make sure that the spirits of the dead crossed over. And each of those people had the responsibility for a certain set of spirits. Mm-hmm. Every spirit in the whole world, but a specific set of them. And then for the past, 1500, 2000 years, it's been sort of spiritually illegal, so to speak, in the Christianized West to deal with ancestors. And so we have this period of time when there have not been people tending to the spirits of the dead and paying attention to this sort of thing. And so now that there's this revived interest, suddenly we get all these people who are like, oh my gosh, it's the spirit of the dead. We have to get them to cross over. And it doesn't really work that way. Not for me anyway. There's always context. And there's always, like for instance, I personally have a responsibility as a spirit worker and a psychopomp to the spirits of the dead in my family and my spiritual community. Mm-hmm. I also have a responsibility toward the spirits of the dead who are attached to the land that I am currently living on. That's where my responsibility ends. If I encounter another spirit outside of that group, I have to decide what the circumstances are and whether I should get involved. There are spirits of the dead who do not need to be guided anywhere. There was a house we rented up in Tennessee years ago. It was in Norris, the town of Norris. It was one of the first houses built in 1933 with the Tennessee Valley Authority project. There was this lovely little historic home. And a couple had owned it for decades and decades and decades. And the gentleman had built absolutely beautiful, exquisite additions onto it himself. He didn't get a contractor. And so he had expanded this home just beautifully. And when we rented it from the people who bought it after he passed away, he was there. And it was his house. It was very clear that he wanted to make sure that people took good care of the house that he had lived in for so many decades, had lived most of his adult life in, had put so much time and care and labor into. He didn't need to go anywhere. He was perfectly happy where he was. He wasn't trapped or tied there or anything. And so we had conversations with him and assured him, that we would take good care of his house, and we did, but he didn't need psychopomping. And there are a lot of people who have not learned to discriminate between spirits that are in distress and spirits that are not. Then again, between spirits that are in distress, it's like a flowchart. So is the spirit in distress or is it not? Okay, in distress. Can I help this spirit that's in distress in a way that will not harm me or the people I'm connected to? And also in a way that will not harm the spirit. And then also, do I have the wherewithal? Do I have the time, the energy, the focus to do the work, because it's not easy. This is not, you know, light a candle and say a prayer. This is pretty heavy duty stuff. It takes a lot of psychic muscle, as both of you know. And so there are a lot of considerations beyond just, oh, this person needs my help. I mean, yeah, we would all like to help everybody. Wouldn't you like to help everybody you pass on the street who's having a hard time and needs help in some way? We would love to rescue everybody. That's the way we are. But I like to go back to the thing that the flight attendants say, which is to put on your own mask before trying to help others. Do not dive into automatically assuming that a spirit needs help, or automatically assuming that it's a good idea for you to help, or even that you're the best one to help them.
Right.
Like, that's such a good point. And, you know, it is, like, I have been very fortunate to have an amazing mentor for the past few decades, someone who I work with very closely in terms of, you know, originally to help me have the skills necessary to kind of navigate this natural affinity with spirits in the deeper world. And then as someone to help, you know, we became partners and would do different, you know, communicating with spirits, helping some spirits cross over that were causing upset among the living. And, you know, it is something that it is heavy work. And for me, as an educator and a writer, I do discuss, you know, the role of psychopomp, connecting to the different aspects of the divine feminine that are associated with death. But I limit that at what I might call more like psycho-spiritual rather than purely working with departed spirits, that it's a tool for helping ourselves connect to our own witchiness, to understand our own mortality, to heal from trauma and so on. Because I do think there is an important like delineation in what can be safely taught in either a book or in like an online course or even like a large group course, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because this is almost like something that requires like a mentorship where you can be, you know, you can watch someone else and how they navigate these experiences. And then that person can help you navigate your own experiences. With, you know, I'm thinking specifically of Restless Dead, but you could kind of expand that to include different things as well. So I do really feel that, like, I'm confident in kind of where I draw that line in my teaching, because I do feel that this is not something for everybody. But I also feel like, because there is probably like a very limited availability of people that someone could find, that there is, it's good to have these conversations about some general things that might be helpful. So I think we've kind of covered quite a few of them. One is, you know, treat the dead as you would treat the living, in terms of you don't have to say yes to them. You can choose not to engage with them. You don't, you know, like this whole thing of like someone is wants my attention. And I think, you know, in trauma work, we talk about like fawning as one of the great responses. And I think there is, I have seen many people who kind of fawn over the dead as like a projected trauma response. You know, like my relationships with the living have not been that great. I'll try the dead. But because they have that trauma like they have a trauma that they carry and a style that they fawn over the dead and become like obsessive with the dead and very preoccupied. And, you know, they want to help all the dead and be with spirits all the time. And because, like, I think the dead, like, they do kind of offer a safety net in a sense that although they can really be disruptive, they are actually dead. So unlike living human beings who can do really egregious harm, and if we kind of step out of like the fantasy world of ghosts and horror movies and whatnot, in my experience, even though the dead can really cause us some distress, they can't hurt us to the same extent that the living can hurt us. Though I know, and I've seen, like, I have had many experiences with students. Well, not many, I shouldn't say many, like a good handful out of like hundreds and hundreds of students. So like a good handful who had like a lot of trauma and did kind of have this natural connection to the dead. And there was a lot of like transference so that they always perceived the dead as like out to get them. And I'm not saying that sometimes the dead aren't malefic, sometimes they are. But in my general experience, part of evaluating whether this spirit is out to get you and is like ruining your life is asking yourself, again, doing like that personal inventory. Like you said, Laura, it's like a flowchart. You know, what is another logical explanation for what's going on here? Is there really a spirit ruining my life? Or am I making irresponsible decisions? You know, is this spirit something I am somehow manifesting myself in order for there to be like a scapegoat for like a safety, you know, like a place where all of my pain and trauma can kind of be externalized to me? So I think there's a lot to understanding like who a spirit is and what a spirit might actually be, because they're not always the departed. But sometimes they are. So there's a lot of kind of personal inquiry that goes into being a psychopomp. So I would say if someone is feeling called to this, or if they have like a sense that there's a departed who is wanting something from them, kind of beyond the just, oh, curious spirits, that, you know, like there it is, this flowchart, personal inquiry. There's no need to rush. First of all, they're already dead. And it's a way for us to really get to know ourselves better in doing psychopomp work, in addition to potentially like helping the departed, if that is something that we feel we're capable of and something they want from us. Because there's a lot to it. So Laura, do you have any kind of final advice for someone who's feeling like the dead are visiting them and they might want to do something in terms of like, because I think there's a delineation, I want to make this clear, a delineation between like someone who's just living their life and the dead are with them, and someone who's like, I want to be a professional psychopomp. So maybe we can tackle the first, which is someone who just feels like the spirits are always with them, and then we'll go around about the second, about being some kind of professional psychopomp.
Well, I mean, if you're just aware of the spirits, then that's just another aspect of your life. Definitely use the same amount of discernment with the spirits of the dead as I do with the living, in terms of whether or not to invite them in or interact with them in any way other than just being aware of them. But I mean, that's, to me at least, that's just another aspect of sort of being aware of all of the non-physical facets of existence. as long as you have a pretty strong spiritual practice to start with, then that's just another set of relationships that you might have. I don't think anyone should feel compelled to actively enter into relationships with the spirits of the dead simply because they're aware of them. I mean, if you were standing in the middle of a crowd of living people, would you feel compelled to walk around and introduce yourself to each one of them and give them your phone number and, you know, invite them to dinner next week or not? So, I mean, they're there all the time. If you're aware of them, that's fine. But yeah, I think maybe a lot of us feel compelled to do something like, oh, well, there are spirits of the dead. What are you going to do about them? Well, I don't know that you have to do anything. They're just there.
It's like humans are just there. Yeah. Like breathing humans are just there. Non-breathing humans are often just there too. But what about becoming like a professional psychopomp? I guess, and another term I've heard a lot is like being a death doula. I think that seems to be fairly like a term that like I hear people using.
Okay. I know several people who title themselves death doulas and death midwives. Mm-hmm. And those people are not psychopomps in my experience. Those are people who deal with the living through the process of death, both the person who is dying and their close family, to help them handle the emotional and psychological, as well as the practical physical aspects of the process. So that's a slightly different.
So they're there for the living, not the dead. Okay.
Yeah. And then a psychopomp takes over once the spirit is no longer inhabiting the body. And for either one, you need real training. I think, yeah, a lot of people, it's hard to get across the idea that you really need training for psychopomp work so that you don't get injured or harmed, and so that the spirits of the dead also don't have problems, without getting into the realm of, oh my gosh, the spirits of the dead, they must be dangerous or something. They're not dangerous. It's just that they're different. Mm-hmm. And this is not stuff that we have information about just hanging around in our culture.
Right.
We don't have background information about how to interact safely with the spirits of the dead. We don't have built-in safeguards in our culture. And because we don't have those, you've got to learn them somewhere. And because of the nature of psychopomp work, this is something that's very difficult to learn from a book or a video. You really need to actually work directly with another person who is accomplished at doing it, so that you can learn to do it safely and efficiently and maintain your own boundaries in the process.
And do it like in a professional, ethical way.
Yes.
And not just be like, one of my things that I find really bothersome is when someone just out of the blue will say to someone else, oh, I have a message from spirit for you, or I have a message from a departed person for you. And the other person is just like going about their life. And, you know, this is part of why I said no in that situation I talked about, because it wasn't like that other person wanted that information.
Right.
And, you know, so I know that's being a medium is not the same as being a psychopomp, but I think in my experience, there's a lot of confusion kind of along, you know, like a psychopomp is in a professional capacity, it is their work to guide souls to the other side. And a medium is someone who is conveying messages, and both really require rigorous ethics around, you know, what's discussed, and how, like, then and the boundaries around what's conveyed to the living in terms of the work, and not glamorizing it. I think it, for me, that's also something I find distasteful. And like you said, not hurting the dead, but I think if we glamorize the dead, it hurts them in a way, just like I wouldn't want to do that to a living person, to use them in that way, you know, for my own gain, in that kind of egoistic way. So I think there is so much to it. This has been such a great conversation. I feel like we just scratched the surface. You know, we could talk. This is a subject that endlessly fascinates me, and I could just talk and talk and talk about it. So thanks again, Laura. I will put the link to your website so everyone will know where to pick up your great book in the show notes. And you can find me and Coyote May in Covina. Check us out. I'll put the link to Covina in there as well. And as always, you'll be able to access the transcript and view this with CC. And all of those links will be in the show as well. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, follow, and comment wherever you are watching or listening to the Keeping Your Keys podcast. It helps us so much. And if you follow the pod, then that way you'll never miss an episode. And we'll know that you're out there watching and listening. So we'll be sure to keep those episodes coming your way. Thanks again. Bye, everyone. The Keeping Your Keys podcast is produced and hosted by me, Cindy Brannon. I'm a witch and psychologist living in coastal Nova Scotia, Canada. I've written several books about Hecate, and also my very first book that's more of an introduction to Awakening the Witch Within. That one's called True Magic. My frequent guests on the show are guides from my school known as Covina, the Coven of Hecate. You'll be listening to them on different episodes. And they are just an amazing group of witches that I am so happy to have in the circle of making this podcast a reality. Episodes usually explore something connected to the goddess Hecate. I became fascinated with the goddess Hecate so long ago. I do deep dives with different partners on goddesses and aspects of Hecate. Sometimes I do more psycho-spiritual episodes where I talk about constructs and how they intersect with the practice of natural magic. And frequently, you'll find meditations. If you're interested in learning more about my work, just go to keepingyourkeys.com. You'll find out more about my books, more about Hecate, and how you can join Covina, the Coven of Hecate. If you enjoy this podcast, be sure to follow it. I usually release new episodes every Thursday. And I would absolutely love it if you could rate and review the podcast. It is so helpful. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, you can send them to info@keepingherkeys.com. Thanks so much for listening, and hail Hecate.